Thank you for inviting me to give this talk. It's sort of a homecoming for me, not in one way, but in multiple ways, because the subject that I'm going to talk about, the subject of generalized global symmetries, was sort of founded at Perimeter Institute. So Davide Gaiotto wrote a seminal work on this topic in 2014, which kickstarted all the research in this field. Over the years, Perimeter has been the home for many of the important developments in the subject later on by Davide Gaiotto and Jaume Gomes, and also Theo Johnson-Freight and many students and postdocs. So I'm going to be talking about a subject of research in this field, which concerns non-invertible symmetries. So this came into limelight around 1.5 years ago, and it has seen a lot of activity since then, because there is a lot of suspicion that that these are going to lead to a lot of interesting physical applications. And in the starting of my talk, I hope to convey what kind of physical applications that can obtain from the study of non-invertible symmetries. So that would be the starting point of my talk. And then after sketching out what kind of applications we can have, I will describe a general physical construction of such non-invertible symmetries, which would be mainly based on this paper highlighted over here in brown. So overall, my talk would be based on these papers. And this is in collaboration with different subsets of these people over here. Leah Bottini is a PhD student at Oxford. Sakura is at Oxford. Apoor Tiwari is a postdoc in Sweden, and Jingxian Wu is a postdoc at Oxford. So as I said, the topic would be about non-invertible symmetries. So let me set the stage a little bit. So the modern point of view is that we should think of global symmetries in quantum field theory as topological defects inside the quantum field theory. And now these topological defects can be invertible, which is the usual kinds of symmetries that we study, or their fusion can be non-invertible, in which case we call the resulting symmetries as non-invertible. So if you think about it, these are quite novel kinds of symmetries, because usually we think of symmetries as some transformation on fields, which can then be inverted. So it becomes hard to understand how a symmetry transformation can be non-invertible in the first place. And the way around it is that these kind of symmetries actually change the dimension of the operators. So they act on local operators and give rise to local operators living at the ends of line operators. So they can take local fields into some non-local fields. And this will become apparent as we go on in this talk. Okay, so as I said, in the starting, I want to give an overview of what kind of physical applications we can obtain, just to motivate the study of such symmetries. Okay, and I will divide the kind of physical applications into two types. So first of all, we have the infrared applications, which is the standard way in which symmetries are used in physics to obtain physical implications. Okay, so here one studies whether a symmetry is spontaneously broken or not in the infrared. So if a symmetry is not spontaneously broken, it doesn't have much consequences for the infrared effective theory that you are going to obtain. But if it's spontaneously broken, it gives rise to interesting physical phenomena. So let's see, I'm going to divide it into three kinds. So the standard global symmetries that we are used to, then higher form symmetries, and a mixture of these two, which are known as higher group symmetries. These are all different kinds of invertible global symmetries to begin. So as is well known, if we have spontaneous symmetry breaking of a standard symmetry, we obtain degenerate backward. And if the symmetry is continuous, we obtain a moduli space of backward. So this is well known. On the other hand, as was pointed out in this paper in this seminal paper introducing higher form symmetries, if a higher form symmetry is spontaneously broken, we obtain higher some gauge theory in the infrared. Okay, this could be a discrete or a continuous gauge theory, or even a higher form gauge theory, depending on what kind of symmetry you're looking at. And this is connected to deconfinement. And now you can combine these two notions. So if you have a higher group symmetry and that spontaneously breaks, then you expect to have both a moduli space of vacuum and also some gauge theories, discrete gauge theories living on top of it. And these gauge theories can form a non-trivial vibration over the moduli space. And what you obtain is the structure of a stack. So when you're studying higher group, spontaneous breaking of higher group symmetries, we should describe infrared theories in terms of infrared physics in terms of moduli stacks. So this is a work in progress. I'm not going to delve more into this at the moment. Okay. Now, there are another kind of physical applications that I would like to discuss. And these, to contrast this with the first kind, let me call them as ultraviolet applications. The idea is as follows. So suppose that you did not have an RG flow to talk about. So for example, you're dealing with some conformal theory. It's a fixed point of RG flow. So there is no way to obtain infrared physical applications. So suppose that this theory has some symmetry, then what physical applications can this have? And so this what symmetry does is it organizes the spectrum of operators or constrains the spectrum of operators if you know something about the spectrum. So let's see it for standard global symmetries in some examples. So first case is that of the group SU2. So suppose you have an SU2 symmetry or standard symmetry, and for some reason you are only able to see the Z2 center inside of it. And you found some operator in your theory, which is charged, which is non-trivially charged under this Z2 center. Then from this information, you can deduce that there must exist another local operator that I'm calling O2 in the theory, which should have non-trivial charge under Z2 as well. And this is distinct from the operator that you began with. And the reason is that any representation of SU2, which has a non-trivial charge under the center, must be at least two-dimensional. So it must be a spin half integer, three half integer, something a spin of 2n+1/2. Okay. Similarly, if you have a standard symmetry of this, your standard symmetry group is S3. So this is the permutation group of three elements. And suppose for some reason you are only tracking a Z3 subgroup of this S3, which corresponds to cyclic permutations. And you, from some analysis, you found that there is some operator in your theory which has a non-trivial charge under Z3. Then again, from just this information, you can infer the existence of another operator in the theory, which combines together with this operator to form a non-trivial representation of S3. This is because if you study the representation theory of S3, here are the S3 irreps, irreducible representations. So there's the trivial one, then there's the sine one in which Z3, in both of these representations, Z3 does not act. And then there is a two-dimensional representation. So if you knew just about Z3, you couldn't infer the existence of this. But as soon as you know that your group is S3, instead of Z3, you can find you can infer the existence of another operator. Okay. So this is a copy from the previous slide. And in fact, you can go even further. So it's not just the genuine local operators need to form representations of the group. There are also twisted sector operators one can study. And these also need to form some sort of representations, usually of some subgroups of this group. So for example, if you're in two dimensions, you can study local operators living at the end of a symmetry generator of a line, a topological line operator, which is generating a Z2 subgroup inside the permutation group. So say that operator is O1. And just if you know this information, you can deduce that there exists two more local operators, O2 and O3, which live at the ends of topological lines, generating some other, the other two Z2 is inside S3. Moreover, this operator can carry a charge under the Z2. It cannot carry a Z3 charge. And this charge, if you know the charge of O1 under Z2, you know the charge of O2 and O3 as well. So in this way, knowing the symmetry, the full symmetry of the theory, and some part of the operator spectrum, one can deduce the existence of other parts of the operator spectrum, just following what representations of that symmetry are allowed. Okay, so one can think about generalizing this to higher dimensions. So for example, if from two dimension you can go to higher dimension, and now twisted sector operators are some higher dimensional objects. So they're not local operators, and one can ask what kind of representations they can form. And this leads to higher representation theory of this group, of the global symmetry group that you have. I will describe this in more detail later, but this is a work in progress. Okay, so let's generalize slightly from standard global symmetry to higher form symmetry. So here again, let's begin. So assume we have a p-form symmetry, and we have a p-dimensional operator that is charged under this symmetry. Then what this means is that there does not exist any p minus one dimensional operator that can live at the end of this p-dimensional operator. So there is no configuration of this form, which I have depicted by saying that dp minus one is zero. Or sometimes it's said more physically that this p-dimensional operator, which is charged under a higher form symmetry, cannot be screened. So this is a sort of representation theory of higher form symmetries. And let's see what happens for higher group when we mix different kinds of higher form symmetries together. So for example purposes, I'm going to choose my higher group to be a two group, which means that I have a zero form standard symmetry and a one form symmetry, and these two mix together. So I'm going to take an example over here, where the zero form symmetry is SO3, one form symmetry is Z2, and there is a mixture between them, which is known as the Posnikov class. And this Posnikov class is the third Stiefel-Whitney class for SO3 bundles. So the reason this is a box tan two group is because the third Stiefel-Whitney class can be represented as box tan of the second Stiefel-Whitney class for a short exact sequence. Okay, so suppose in any dimensions you have a quantum field theory which admits this kind of box tan two group symmetry. Then what are the physical consequences? What kind of representations do operators form in such a theory? So first of all, we can begin by looking at completely genuine local operators. So completely genuine local operators form representations of the zero form group. So which we know, which is the input information, it's an SO3. So they form SO3 representations. That means they must form integer spin representations and not half integer spin representations of the SU2 Lie algebra. Okay, then we have a Z2 one form symmetry group. And as we just discussed, this means that we have a line operator. A line operator charged under it cannot end. So let me denote such a line operator as L. And now let's square this line operator. Let's look at now this line operator is not charged, so it can end. And at its end, it can support some local operators. But the fact that you're dealing with a non-trivial two group rather than a zero form symmetry times a one form symmetry, the mixing by this Posnikov class means that the operators that live at the end of this line must form SU2 representations, which are not SO3 representations. That means they must be half integer spins. They must carry half integer spins rather than integer spins. So this is a theory in which if this was a conformal theory, for example, and you were doing some bootstrap calculation and you found an operator charge under the center of SU2, which means that it's in a half integer spin representation, then you know that such an operator must be a non-genuine operator. It cannot be a genuine operator, for example. And if you find an operator which has integer spin, then it must be a genuine operator, or at least living at the end of a line which has a trivial charge. Okay. And then you can consider the cube of this line. This cannot end either. And then the sequence repeats. So L to the 4 line will have SO3 operators and so on. So if you see, so there are many kinds of situations in which one can actually study various kinds of operators that are arising in the theory, including extended and local operators. So for example, you might have a string construction of some higher dimensional superconformal field theory, then wrapping brains in that string construction, one can construct these kinds of operators. And then one can study and try to study what are the representations they form. And if one sees a pattern like this, the one that I described, this fourfold pattern, where you have the genuine operators form SO3, but the ones living at the end of L squared form SU2, and L cannot end, then one can infer from this property that there is a higher group symmetry, or there is this boxed 10-2 group symmetry in this theory. And this was used in a lot of works over the past couple of years in various sort of contexts, in five-dimensional, six-dimensional SCFTs, and even in three-dimensional n=4 theories, in various kinds of gauge theories in various dimensions. And as I described earlier, one can generalize it to any kind of higher group. And then the operators in the theory form higher representations of the higher group. Okay, so now let me describe physical applications of non-invertible symmetries in this language. Okay, so here, let's discuss the first kind of applications that we discussed for invertible symmetries. Let's begin with some infrared applications. So here, suppose we have some quantum field theory, and there is some invertible or non-invertible symmetry S which is acting on it, which is a global symmetry of this theory. Now, if this theory is gapped, in the infrared, this quantum field theory flows to a topological quantum field theory, and this S symmetry has to act on this topological quantum field theory. So if one can just constrain what are the possible topological quantum field theories with S symmetry, one can understand various infrared consequences for having a symmetry in the UV quantum field theory. So here, let me give you an example. So suppose you have a gapped two-dimensional quantum field theory, which admits Ising symmetry. So Ising symmetry is a non-invertible symmetry. It comprises of some topological line operators in the theory. So there are two non-trivial topological lines, P and S, and they have the following fusion rules. In particular, notice that the square of S gives you a sum of two topological operators. And this is the hallmark of a non-invertible symmetry, the appearance of sum in the fusion rule. Right? So if you have any two-dimensional quantum field theory which admits such a symmetry, then one can definitely say that in the infrared, it must have a multiple of three back one. So at minimum, you must have at least three back one. You cannot have one or two. So notice that there is a Z2 invertible symmetry subgroup of this Ising symmetry, which is generated by P. It squares to one. And first, if you only knew about the Z2 symmetry, you couldn't have made this conclusion, because the Z2 symmetry could have been spontaneously broken or could have been spontaneously preserved. So if it was spontaneously broken, you would obtain two vacuum. And if it was spontaneously preserved, you would obtain one vacuum in the infrared. The presence of Ising means that for this Z2 symmetry, both of these phases come to combine together. And that's why you have a multiple of three vacua. In each unit of three vacua, two of the vacua are permuted by the Z2 symmetry, and one vacuum is not. Okay. And for the experts, let me also mention a side remark. So a two-dimensional topological quantum field theory is not just specified by the number of vacua. You also have to specify relative Euler terms between the different vacua. There is a global Euler term which can always be removed. It acts as a counter term. But there are relative ones that you have to take into account. And in this situation, this TQFT, TQFT of three vacuum, which is an irreducible representation of the Ising symmetry that I'm talking about, has some relative Euler terms between it as well. But the key point is that you can completely pin it down. There are finite number of TQFTs given some discrete symmetry. There are finite number of TQFTs which have that symmetry. And then any gap theory must flow to a direct sum of such TQFTs. Okay. Now let me discuss some ultraviolet applications. So applications for the operator spectrum. So again, consider that you have a two-dimensional quantum field theory. And again, with Ising symmetry, what kind of implications does having Ising symmetry have? So we have to begin with knowing something about the spectrum. So say we know that there is some operator, let me call it O sigma. And this operator has the property that it's charged under the Z2 subsymmetry of Ising. And just from knowing that this operator exists, I can infer the existence of another operator in the theory. This operator must be a twisted sector operator for the Z2 subsymmetry. So it lives at the end of the topological line generating the P symmetry. And let me call it O mu. And furthermore, its charge under Z2 must be trivial. So here you can see this is because a non-invertible symmetry is mapping this operator O sigma into this twisted sector operator O mu. And here you concretely see that the fields, some local fields in your theory, are being mapped to non-local fields. So an example of a 2D QFT with Ising symmetry is Ising conformal theory itself. And in that case, O sigma can be taken to be the spin or the order operator, which is clearly charged under the Z2 symmetry, which flips the sign of the spin. And O mu in this case is the usually what is known as the disorder operator. So Ising CFT satisfies this constraint. But more generally, any two-dimensional quantum field theory which admits an Ising symmetry and an operator O sigma must admit an operator O mu, a disorder operator O mu. Okay, so this brings me to the end of my motivation for studying non-invertible symmetries. A lot of this is a work in progress and is yet to appear, but I hope that this establishes a ground, a motivation for studying constructions of non-invertible symmetries and their mathematical structure, which will be the main topic of my talk. In later part of my talk. Okay. So now I'm going to shift gears and going to describe a construction of non-invertible symmetries. It's quite general construction, which is valid across various space-time dimensions, and it's very physically motivated. So, and these will be called as theta symmetries because they are generalizations of theta angles, as we will see. So we begin with the quantum field theory in any space-time dimension on which there is some symmetry S that acts as a global symmetry. So here I'm going to specialize this S to be either a usual symmetry or a higher form symmetry or higher group symmetry. So in general, any kind of invertible symmetry. Okay. And then I gauge the symmetry. So assume this is non-anomalous and gauge the symmetry. Now we obtain another d-dimensional quantum field theory. Let's call it QFT mod S, the one obtained after gauging it. And the crucial point we are going to use is that this system admits within it a subsector described by gauge fields for this symmetry S. Okay, so we have a, so the idea to construct symmetries inside this, inside this gauge theory QFT mod S is as follows. So here, this is, this box shows the world volume of the quantum field theory QFT mod S. And let's, inside this world volume, let's pick a p-dimensional sub-world volume and insert a topological quantum field theory of space-time dimension P, where P is less than the space-time dimension of this quantum field theory. So let's insert it along such a sub-world volume. And then moreover, let's specify some coupling of this topological quantum field theory to the gauge fields, so the S gauge fields for this symmetry that we have gauged. Okay, so if we manage to do that, then we construct a topological defect in this quantum field theory, which has the dimension P. We can phrase this discussion equivalently as follows. So the choice of coupling can be absorbed into a way of symmetrizing the topological quantum field theory that we are adding. So let's engage the symmetry S and go back to our original quantum field theory on which S was acting as a global symmetry. And inside this, let's insert the same TQFT, but along with that, we pick a way of symmetrizing under S, it under the symmetry S. So we actually pick an S-symmetric TQFT. And then we are going to gauge this symmetry S all over the space-time. So as we gauge it in the bulk of space-time, we just land back onto the new quantum field theory, the gauge theory. But when we gauge it over the world volume of this TQFT, we are going to pick a diagonal combination of the S symmetry. And this picking this diagonal combination chooses a canonical way to couple this TQFT into the to the bulk quantum field theory. Okay, so after gauging, we will obtain a situation as shown on the right hand side over here. So in the bulk, we have the gauged quantum field theory, but along this p-dimensional world volume, where we made some modifications, we obtain a topological defect of this quantum field theory. And I want to emphasize that this is really a defect in the theory. It cannot be pulled out into a decoupled topological quantum field theory, as it could have been done on the left-hand side. So it's glued on top of the bulk quantum field theory. And this constructs the topological a topological defect, which by definition is a global symmetry of the gauged quantum field theory. Okay, so now I can describe why I'm calling them as theta symmetries. This is because theta angle is a special case of this scenario, it's a limiting case. So if you take this dimension P of the TQFT to be the same as the space-time dimension, and you pick the underlying topological quantum field theory to be the trivial theory, the only information is in the how you symmetrize it, which corresponds to an SPT phase for this S symmetry, then you obtain what is known as theta angle. If you follow this gauging procedure, then at the end, you will obtain not this theory, which is gauged, but a modification of it throughout the whole space-time, which means that you have added a theta angle. Another point to note is that this is a universal construction. So all I assume is that there was a d-dimensional quantum field theory. D could have been anything. And all I assumed is that it had non-anomalous S symmetry. And after gauging it, the gauged theory must have all of these theta symmetries. So it is quite universal in this sense. Okay, so I will get into the consequences of the, I will explore the structure of these theta symmetries in the next few slides. But are there any questions at this moment?
Is S necessarily discrete?
Yes, here S is discrete. I should have mentioned that. Thanks. Okay, if there are no questions, let me proceed. So let's explore the structure of theta symmetries. And let me take P is equal to 1. So I'm going to insert some topological quantum mechanics into my bulk quantum field theory and see what kind of theta defects I obtain as a consequence. And moreover, I'm going to specialize this symmetry S to a standard zero-form symmetry group, group G, and it's going to be taken to be finite group, as Justin mentioned. Okay, so now we want to pick a one-dimensional topological quantum field theory. So this is a quantum mechanics. So it's simply specified by specifying the Hilbert space of it. This is just a finite dimensional vector space. Let's call it V. Now we want to actually not pick, we want to G-symmetrize it, this TQFT. So we want to describe some action, an action of G on V. For requiring this G symmetry to be non-anomalous, this should convert V into a genuine representation of G rather than a projective representation. So it converts V into some representation R of G. And then, so from this, what you learn is that theta symmetries for P equals to 1 are specified by objects or are specified by representations of G, which can be understood as objects inside this, inside a category, which is the category of representations of G. Okay. So the fusion, notice that the fusion is non-invertible whenever G is non-abelian. So we have already produced examples of some non-invertible symmetries. And if you note, these can actually be identified with Wilson lines. So as is well known, whenever we gauge any kind of group symmetry, we obtain Wilson lines after gauging, Wilson line defects in the theory after gauging. And if the group is finite, then these Wilson lines are topological. So they generate some symmetries of the quantum field theory. So we have reproduced Wilson lines as examples of theta symmetries. And another way to say it is that theta symmetries for a zero-form symmetric group at P equals to 1 can be identified with what are known as dual or quantum symmetries. So this dual symmetries is a general notion that whenever we gauge a higher form symmetry, we obtain a dual, after gauging, in the gauge theory, we obtain a dual higher form symmetry. And theta symmetries reproduce precisely these dual symmetries. So if you could have done the same exercise for higher form groups rather than a zero form group. And in that case, so for a P form symmetry group, we would take theta symmetries at level P. And these theta symmetries at level P would precisely coincide at level P plus one. And these theta symmetries at level P plus one would precisely coincide with the dual D minus P minus two form symmetry that you obtain. Okay, so let's explore it a little bit further. What is the structure at P is equal to 2? So for P equal to 2, we want to understand G symmetric 2D topological QFTs. And up to a global Euler number counter term, they're classified as follows. So first of all, you pick a subgroup H inside your group G. And what this tells you is what is the symmetry that is spontaneously unbroken. And so in this such a TQFT, the number of vacua is the number of H cosets. And in each vacuum, we have a subgroup H which is unbroken, or a G transform of H. Okay. The second piece of information to specify a G-symmetric 2D TQFT is the choice of an element in the second group cohomology of H with coefficients in U1. So let me call it sigma. And this can be understood physically as an SPT phase for this unbroken symmetry H. So a general G-symmetric 2D TQFT is thus a mixture of what are known as SPT phases and what are known as spontaneously symmetric broken phases. So it combines these two things. And mathematically, it's known that this is precisely the classification of objects of a two category, which is the two category of two representations of this group G. So there is we saw that for P equals to 1, we obtain objects of rep G, and for P equals to 2, we obtain objects of 2 rep G. So it's natural to conjecture that for any general P, what we are going to obtain theta symmetries would be objects of a P category, or the P category formed by P representations of the group G. Okay, and now at level P equals to 2, the fusion is non-invertible already for abelian G. We don't even need to go to non-abelian groups to obtain non-invertible symmetries. And you can think of it as generalizations of dual or quantum symmetries. So whenever you gauge a zero form symmetry, you don't only just obtain a D minus 2 form symmetry described by Wilson lines, but you also obtain some higher high dimensional topological operators, which are captured by these theta symmetries. Okay, so let's see an example. So take the simplest example, say the group is Z2, and let's study its two representations. So there are two representations which are irreducible. There is first of all the trivial two representation, which has dimension one. And this physically is in this language that I introduced on the top. It corresponds to no spontaneous breaking of this Z2. So Z2 is spontaneously preserved in this, it has a single vacuum, which is the dimension, which I'm calling as the dimension here. And this is spontaneously preserved, and there is no SPT phase there for Z2 in two dimensions that can arise because the cohomology group is trivial. And this can be identified as the identity surface operator after gauging. So this is not interesting, but there is an interesting a non-trivial two representation of Z2. This one is dimension two. So it corresponds to a 2D TQFT with two vacua, and Z2 exchanges these two vacua. So it's a Z2 spontaneous symmetry breaking phase. And after gauging, following the previous analysis, once you gauge the Z2 symmetry in the gauged QFT, you would obtain a topological surface operator corresponding to this two representation. Let me call it D2Z2. And this operator has non-invertible fusion rules because the tensor product of these two representations has non-invertible tensor product decomposition. And the fusion rule is as follows. If you take a product of two of these two representations, you obtain the sum of these two representations. Okay, so are there any questions at this moment?
Is the, like you insert a G symmetric defect, is the form, like is the symmetry form degree bounded by like the dimension of the defect you insert, or are the two tied in some way?
I assumed a zero form, but if you start with one form, then you begin at surface defects and higher. Okay. So there are no lines that you can...
Right. Okay.
Yeah. Okay, so let me continue. So here I have an aside. So earlier I mentioned that operators in a quantum field theory, which has a zero form symmetry, should form higher representations of that group. And since we just saw the structure of two representations of group, we should be able to see what kind of operators are there in quantum field theory that form two representations. So as we know, local operators form one representations, the usual representations. So one level up, line operators form two representations of a group. So, and the map works as follows. So recall that a two representation had a subgroup of G and the choice of this H2 element. The subgroup of G describes the subgroup that does not permute the line in that two representation. So the H cosets in G are going to describe the number of lines that can be permuted as you cross the co-dimension one operator generating the G symmetry. zero form symmetry. And then moreover, this choice of sigma describes a projective representation of H that is living on this line. So that means that as you take H operators and you intersect one such line, the line is not changed, it's left invariant, but the local operators living at the junctions can have non-trivial fusion. As you fuse them, you can produce some extra phases, which are described by this H2 element. And this is known as a symmetric fractionalization on top of lines and was discussed in two papers last year in quite detail. What was discussed in these papers can be expressed by saying that line operators in a quantum field theory with zero form symmetry form two representations of that symmetry group. Okay. And similarly, now you can ask, what do local operators between two line operators form? So we discussed local operators, genuine local operators, which are not attached to any lines, form representations of G. But what about local operators between two lines corresponding to two different non-trivial two representations? And they can be understood as intertwiners between these two representations. Or in other words, inside this two category of two representations, they form one morphism. Okay, so this is the picture for a general zero form symmetry group, but you could also consider two representations of a two group if you have a two group symmetry, and in that case, very interesting structures appear, and for higher dimensional operators, you see higher representations. Okay, so now let me continue on with the structure of theta symmetries. So as I said, for higher levels, now we would expect to see even higher representations. But understanding the structure of these higher representations from three representations onward can be quite tricky. It can be subtle. And the reason for this is that there are an infinite number of G-symmetric TQFTs, for example, three-dimensional G-symmetric TQFTs, which are simple or irreducible. They cannot be decomposed as a direct sum of other G-symmetric TQFTs. So this is related to the existence of topological order that opens up in three dimensions. And these G-symmetric TQFTs then describe symmetry and rich topological phases in condensed matter. And also, there is an interesting connection to the work of Davide and Theo in 2019. So you can obtain all of these simple elements inside three representations of a group by condensation completing or Karubi completing the trivial 3D TQFT. So what condensation completion means is that you start with the trivial theory, and then you add in all 3D TQFTs that can be obtained by performing gaugings of this trivial theory. So that would give you all the 3D TQFTs which are relevant for the analysis, and then you G-symmetrize them to obtain three representations of G. So roughly, they should be classified by G-graded spherical fusion categories. Okay, so that's the story from three representations and beyond. It's quite, the structure is not quite manageable at the moment. But now let me discuss a generalization of theta symmetries, which I will refer to as twisted theta symmetries. So there'll be an extra twist into the construction that we will introduce. Okay, so this goes as follows. We again consider a quantum field theory with symmetry S acting on it, a global symmetry S. And now inside this, instead of just having a TQFT there, let's consider a topological defect, a p-dimensional topological defect of this quantum field theory. Okay, so first of all, it might be possible to couple it to background S. Background gauge fields for the S symmetry. In that case, you can just simply gauge S symmetry and obtain a topological defect in the gauge theory. But it often happens that this topological defect that we are considering cannot be coupled in a consistent way to background gauge fields. So there can be some kinds of obstructions. So there are two kinds of obstructions one usually encounters. First is the Thoeft anomaly, and second is symmetry fractionalization, which is a more obstructive than a Thoeft anomaly. And then you can even have more obstructive things. And in both of these cases, the obstruction can actually be cured. So how you cure it is you take a TQFT and you stack it on top of this topological defect, a decoupled TQFT of the same dimension. You stack it on top of this topological defect and you obtain another topological defect shown over here on the right hand side. But now the addition of this TQFT cures the problem and you are able to couple to background as gauge fields. Okay. So in the case of when the obstruction was just a Thoeft anomaly for the S symmetry, this TQFT is just a TQFT which carries S symmetry with the opposite anomaly. On the other hand, if you have more general, if you have symmetry fractionalization, then you need to have degenerate VACCO in this TQFT. And then when you stack this TQFT on top of the topological defect, you create a direct sum of topological defects in a sense, and then you can mix the symmetry action on this topological defect along with the number of VACCO, which removes the symmetry fractionalization. Okay, so now once you obtain this topological defect, which can be coupled consistently to S-gauge fields, background S-gauge fields, you choose one such choice of coupling, and given such a topological defect plus a choice of coupling, you can now gauge the symmetry and obtain a topological defect in the theory obtained after gauging. So I would like to emphasize that there can be multiple choices of couplings. And this is quite crucial for things to work out. Okay, and these in this way, the symmetries that you produce are non-universal, clearly, because they depend on, there was a twist involved, there was a defect that we began with. So it depends on what kind of defect is there in the theory that you're considering, not just on what kind of symmetry is there acting on the theory. So it's non-universal, it produces non-universal symmetries. So this construction of twisted theta symmetries reproduces many known constructions of non-invertible symmetries that have appeared in the literature recently, including these two papers, which kickstarted activity in this in the study of non-invertible symmetries and higher dimensional quantum field theories. Okay, so I would like to go into now some examples of twisted theta symmetries. Are there any questions at this moment?
Doesn't sound like I have any questions, but about 10-minute warning.
Okay. So let me consider some examples. So here, so this is an example where we are trying to gauge, we have a theory T. In any space-time dimension, in three space-time dimension, I'm going to restrict to three space-time dimension over here, which has a Z2 times Z2 global symmetry acting on it. And we are going to gauge Z2 times Z2 as a sequential gauging process. We are first going to gauge a Z2 subgroup inside Z2 times Z2 and the remaining residual Z2 symmetry later. Okay, so we know that if I directly gauge Z2 times Z2, I obtain two representations of Z2 times Z2. So I can just write them down. These are the theta symmetries for this gauging procedure. And now I would like to obtain all of these two representations as sequential gaugings. Okay, so here are the defects. Here are the topological defects that we are going to consider. So Z2 times Z2 has some surface operators, which are labeled by D2. So subscript 2 denotes the dimension of the defect. And then the superscript labels various elements inside the Z2 times Z2 group. So we have the identity group and then identity element, and there are three Z2 elements inside it, which are labeled as S, V, and C. And we are going to first guess the Z2 subgroup generated by V. We could have chosen some other ones. Okay. And so we only need to consider the fate of two. We are going to use the twisted theta construction now. So we are going to study what happens to the identity operator after gauging and this operator S after gauging. What happens to V and C is the same as what happens for identity and S, because they are related to these. They are related by left multiplication by what we are gauging, which is V. So this is what happens. So from identity, we obtain two representations of Z2. And as we saw, this is the trivial two representation, the identity operator, and a Z2, a non-trivial two representation, which is denoted as D2Z2. Okay. And from S, again, you obtain another copy of two representations of Z2. So you obtain the residual Z2 symmetry, S symmetry, and then a combination of these two, which is denoted as SZ2. Okay. Now interesting aspects of theta symmetry, twisted theta symmetries start coming into the picture. So when we start with identity now to gauge the residual S symmetry, we obtain the identity and the two representation, the theta symmetry, but there is another symmetry that appears from identity, which is an invertible Z2 symmetry in this theory. So in the Z2 times Z2 setting, this corresponded to 2DT QFT, which had an SPT phase for the Z2 times Z2. Okay, and this is obtained by choosing a different kind of coupling to the background Z2 gauge fields. So here you are taking the identity defect as shown over here, and you want to make it symmetric under S. And now at the junction, you can either put the identity line or the dual quantum symmetry line that you obtain in this Z2 gauging procedure, which I'm calling D1B. The identity line leads to the usual theta symmetries, and putting this new coupling leads to twisted theta symmetry D2 minus. And similarly, you can begin with D2Z2 and you obtain two copies again. So you obtain on top of this, you can either stack the trivial two representation, which leads to this one, or you can stack the two-dimensional two representation, which leads to this one. And there is another one because you can choose a non-trivial line operator when you as a junction operator. So this all works out. You can similarly consider gauging Z4 by gauging two Z2s. Okay, and so there is a Z2 subgroup inside Z4. When you gauge that, at that level, everything looks the same as in the Z2 times Z2 case. But there is a Thoft anomaly between the residual Z2 symmetry, zero form symmetry here, and the dual one form symmetry that we obtain in three dimensions. And what this Thoft anomaly does is it introduces some symmetry fractionalizations on top of the surfaces. So what this means is that as you take S surface intersections with this one of these surfaces, they do not fuse to form a Z2, but rather a Z4. And because of this obstruction, many of the things that were appearing in Z2 times Z2 drop out because they cannot be constructed anymore. So the one shown over here in red drop out, and we only obtain a subset of those things. And these are precisely the Z4 two representation. They are much less in number than Z2 times Z2 ones. So this is a consistency check of twisted theta construction. All right. So now let me summarize what we discussed. So I discussed a construction of non-invertible symmetries, which I dubbed as theta symmetries or twisted theta symmetries. And what these do is they systematize and unify various kinds of constructions of non-invertible symmetries that have appeared in the literature so far. Okay, they are related to what are usually known as dual or quantum symmetries. So theta symmetries should be thought of as the most general quantum symmetries that emerge after you gauge a group symmetry or a higher group symmetry. There are very deep mathematical connections. So these their connections to higher representations and higher projective representations of groups and higher groups, which are very interesting fusion higher categories that are being explored in the mathematics literature. And physically, these higher representations, as we saw, can have two avatars. So first of them, you can think of them as these dual or quantum symmetries. And second, you could think of them as describing the what are the charges of non-invertible symmetry. So what are the representations that all the non-topological and topological operators in your quantum field theory must form, just because the theory has that symmetry. Okay, there are interesting connections with condensed matter physics. So we saw that the study of theta symmetries includes within it, as a special case, the study of SPT phases, SET phases, SSB phases, and so on. And there are a plethora of physical applications, as I discussed in the first half of my talk. One can constrain infrared physics and the spectrum of local and extended operators in a quantum field theory with symmetry. So thank you very much for your attention.
Let's thank Lexia. Are there any further questions? Davide or Justin? Okay, I'll take the smiley faces of the questions that were asked during your talk. Speaker again, and I'll keep the Zoom running if Davide wants to say anything or like to the afternoon. But I'll, yeah.
So, any feedback on? So, there were a lot of experimental things in the starting of the talk regarding some infrared applications and constraints on operator spectrum. And I wanted to run it by the audience at Perimeter. So any feedback would be appreciated.
What do you feel is the most interesting physical application until now?
So we have been exploring, and various groups have been exploring a lot of the structure of these symmetries. So how to construct them in the first place, so that we can, and then physical applications have only started showing them. For me, these constraining the number of vacua and the infrared physics was something very interesting, but this is something to appear yet. It hasn't appeared. And also that the operators from higher representations. So this is what I didn't appreciate. I knew that local operators form representations and zero form symmetries can act on line operators and there can be symmetric fractionalization, but this structure is precisely a two representation. And then for two groups, you can have two representations of two groups. So that's they show different kinds of structure. That was also something very interesting.
I mean, I guess that one possible application of these things is just to engineer models with these symmetries in the UV so that you can have control on what happens in the infrared. That is papers that build lattice models with some exotic.
No. Yeah, so I think it's... there are some interesting things there. So if you, for example, even study some simple non-invertible symmetries, like you're gauging an S3. So in the ultraviolet, you have some two representations of S3 symmetry after gauging. So when you do it with representation S3, already in the infrared, you can see that there are some exotic TQFTs that appear. There is a theory with 4 vacua, and there is a theory with 3 vacua, but not with 2 vacua. So, and for S3, you do not have this 4 vacuum theory. So there is some non-trivial mixing of vacua that happens when you gauge S3. Which can't just be seen by just simple number theory, because the 4 has nothing to do with S3. So I believe for 2 rep S3, there might be some interesting infrared constraints as well, but I still need to work on it. And then as I discussed this icing example, so you must have a multiple of 3 vacua. This was a surprise to me that there is only 1 TQFT in the infrared that can have icing symmetry.
Yeah, it's funny. I mean, if you simulate the theory with icing symmetry on the lattice, you typically find the CFT. You don't find the gapped system.
Mm-hmm. So there is this tricritical icing, and there is an relevant operator 5, 1, 3 inserted with the negative sign. You obtain a gap theory in the IR.
I see.
And in that case, it's known that there are exactly 3 vacua, so that's consistent with this. So in general, one can start with any RCFT and do these kind of deformations. One can preserve icing in many, many models. So this is a constraint for all of them. If the physics is gapped in the infrared, which it could be, in many cases it is, you must have a multiple of 3.
Okay, should we call it a day at that, or?
So thank you again for inviting me. It was a pleasure speaking
with you. Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.